मशीन लगाऊंगा, इस साइड से आलू घुसेगा, उस साइड से सोना निकलेगा।
Welcome to this episode of Attention Please. So I'm back to being the only host, and today the topics that I'm going to cover are going to be the exact same things that I've been covering for the last few weeks, which is the Bengal elections. For those of you who are not interested in Bengal elections, and I don't know why you would not be, this might not be the episode for you. The reason I'm spending so much time on the Bengal elections is firstly, because of course I'm Bengali, this has a lot of personal import for me. Also, this is a state that I hopefully understand better than I understand other states, mainly because I grew up here. And also because politics in Bengal is extremely entertaining. And one of the things that I have been greatly enjoying over the past, few weeks, has been to follow Republic Bangla on YouTube and just enjoy the Bengali debates, not the least of which is because of Arnab Goswami's stilted Bengali and the fact that there's actually another kind of Bengali translator who sits there, who's of course fluent in Bengali, kind of brings the verbal bombast in Bengali, and the exchanges are very, very, you know, the kind that you would expect at Para Rock, which is really a community adda place. And so voices are raised. And again, it might not be very dissimilar to what you see on the English and the Hindi channel or Republic, but just the use of vernacular, you know, there's nothing that actually hits home more than the use than seeing a fight being fought in the vernacular that you grew up in. It's almost like eating Bedouin's biryani. There is almost a direct connection with your past when you see people fighting each other in Bengali, because that's really what I have seen growing up. So there's this comforting familiarity with the proceedings on screen. I don't feel that level of comfort when I see people fighting in Hindi. Anyways, so with respect to Bengal, I think the biggest news this week was a recorded conversation of Mamata Banerjee pleading with a pretty low-level Trinamool Congress operative who had defected to the BJP and who is, a people mobilizer in the constituency that she's fighting in, that she's fighting Shubhendu Adhikari in, to kind of come back. And, you know, that phone call, if you hear Mamata Banerjee's voice, I mean, there's none of the bombast, none of the arrogance. It's like, Baba, phirote shona ki hobe, are ja hawar hoye geche, you know, that kind. I mean, she is apparently the most powerful person in Bengal, and just to hear her speak like this in this very, for those of you who have followed Mamata Banerjee's career like I have, it's entirely fraud tone of voice. I mean, she's hardly that person, but to see her kind of being very polite, very polite, very understanding, very, unbelievingly polite with a pretty low-level Trinamool Congress operative, but a person who has some influence in the constituency in which he's fighting in, for her to call him and ask him to defect is significant in many ways. First of all, it's significant in the sense that it is grossly unethical. Again, one would say that in Bengal politics, and that's a point well taken, there is nothing which is ethical. But this is like just when the elections have begun, the first phase has already started. You're trying to, even at that point of time, you're trying to reach out and swing. Essentially, this is, you know, Mamata Banerjee loves to use the word match fixing in her rallies. I mean, this is no different than match fixing. So she's basically reaching out to a person in the opposition camp after the elections have started. And the person who also talks to Mamata Banerjee, he's obviously recording it, so he's on his best behavior. So he tells Mamata Banerjee, look, I have great respect for you and we've always been your supporters, but I can't betray my current party. And also, you know, so apparently this guy wanted a residency certificate for something. And because he was not seeing eye to eye with Trinamool Congress. He was basically told on his face that you're not going to get it. What are you going to do? It's our rule. You know, here's the middle finger. So that's what he was telling Mamata Banerjee, that I can't believe that I couldn't get a residency certificate. And how could that be? This is just so. And Mamata Banerjee was like, I totally understand. I heard that later. This was not this shouldn't have happened. You know, it won't happen again. So she was very, very kind and understanding. It's like a manager trying to, you know, get back and an engineer, you know, he's written some code and he didn't leave comments and he's left the company, or he was possibly fired or laid off. And then they realize that they don't know how the code works. They need to modify the code. They need to maintain it. But he didn't leave any comments. So they now need the guy back. And this actually happens many times with like legacy programming languages. So, you know, with my software engineering background, that's the first thing that came to my mind, that Mamata Banerjee sounds like a harried manager trying to get one of their individual contributors back. And the individual contributor is no mood to come back to this company. So I found that amusing. But, you know, firstly, there's the ethical aspect of this. But secondly, I think it shows that despite the bravado and despite the public pronouncements, the Trinamool Congress will win upward of 200 seats. It's even at the level of Mamata Banerjee, realistically, they know that this is going to be a very close fight. As I said weeks before, I think that my prediction is that I still think that perhaps the Trinamool Congress is going to win more seats than BJP, but it's not going to be able to form a government on its own. It might need the help of the CPM and the Congress. So that would be interesting. And that's really the only card that the CPM and the Congress have. This is the only way that these two losers can come back to power, because they will have perhaps 15 to 17 seats that they can then barter for either a place in the government or for them to get their policies and their people really in. I mean, you can always exert influence without actually being part of the government. And if you really need to read the handbook of that, I think it would be written by Sonia Gandhi. So this was interesting in that respect. Now, while this was going on, I was kind of having this, I was thinking about who is likely to be the BJP's chief ministerial candidate. And now that it seems likely, I mean, before the elections began, I felt that their main target was Sourav Ganguly. As I said many years ago, that Sourav Ganguly going up against Mamata Banerjee would be that would be a battle for the ages. That would have definitely, if that was happening, I would have predicted a BJP victory if they had been able to get Sourav Ganguly on the ticket. Because if there's anybody who has that level of influence and that personal connect with Bengalis, regardless of age and education level and location, it's Sourav Ganguly. And I also felt that he would be a good leader in the sense that his leadership as a captain of India was marked by, you know, he took over a team which was devastated by match fixing, and he took the team to a different level. And he inspired great loyalty among the players who played for him. All of them have great things to say about him, even years after he's kind of ceased to have any influence over them. And he's credited with taking out selectorial parochialism from the Indian cricket team. It was pretty much a quota-driven system before that. And Sourav Ganguly essentially wiped that out. And so, of course, you know, people like Dhoni and took it to another level after Ganguly. And I also feel that Dhoni should get into politics at some point of time. But I was really rooting for Ganguly to get into politics, because I think that good people should get into politics. And I can't think of somebody better than Ganguly, despite his faults as an individual. Now, that boat has sailed. I think this was something which was actively being considered. And when he became the president of the BCCI with Amit Shah's son, I felt this was kind of, you know, that basically, you know, Sourav Ganguly was essentially dating the BJP at that point of time, no commitment, just to see if we can work together. And whatever transpired, I think that the reason why Ganguly didn't go for BJP was that Ganguly was afraid, you know, what happens if he loses because he has a lot of business interests in Bengal, lots, and he stands to lose. And of course, if he loses, then Mamata Banerjee is not going to let him go. So given the fact she's okay with him being close to the BJP, but if she fights against BJP because against Mamata Banerjee, because there's one thing about Mamata Banerjee is that the supreme sense of, the only thing that Mamata Banerjee understands is, are you for her or are you against her? I mean, this is a person who has no inherent beliefs in anything. She does not come from an ideology. Her ideology is primarily dominated by personal loyalty towards her. So anybody who essentially bends their knee and, that person is somebody that Mamata Banerjee is okay with. Anybody who looks at her and tries to come off as a competitor, she is going to destroy them. There's no difference between this and Donald Trump. So their entire worldview is through the prism of themselves. So Ganguly is smart enough to know that. So I think that was, I think some of his health problems, his heart attacks and stuff, and I'm speculating here, it kind of comes to this, it goes to show the kind of stress he was under. And so now that, that sale, I thought that the next thing was, it seemed to be that it was going to be Mithun Chakravarti, because even though I felt that Mithun Chakravarti was a way inferior candidate, despite me being a fan of Mithun Chakravarti as a movie star, Mithun Chakravarti did not have the gravitas, he did not have the leadership, and essentially he stands for nothing. So, and whether he goes to this, going on a political stage and, regurgitating Chawani lines from his movies, that's not really, that's not the kind of politician that people should aspire to elect. There should be some kind of belief, there should be some kind of ideology, right, wrong, whatever you feel, but that person should believe in something. That person should have had some experience. And Mithun Chakravarti has had no experience with anything other than, of course, acting. He's a very good actor, but that doesn't make him. And he's old enough, again, young in terms of Indian politics, I guess, but still, for the rest of the world, he's had his years. And he's never leveraged it to make a political point, other than basically look after his own interests. So he started out as a Naxalite, when became close to the Shiv Sena when he was in Bombay, because that aligned with his business interests. Then, with Trinamool Congress, when it suited his business interests, and now with BJP. So, but it was true that Mithun Chakravarti has a pan-Bengal appeal. He is popular. He will definitely get in the crowds. And even though I would have felt that, if you really ask me in terms of, and I say this with great understanding of the impact of what I'm saying, but if you ask me between Mamata Banerjee and Mithun Chakravarti, I would still prefer Mamata Banerjee as a chief minister, because at least he has some experience and something that I think Mithun Chakravarti does not have. But it seems increasingly that Mithun Chakravarti is also not going to be the chief ministerial candidate of Bengal, because he's not running. He's not running as an MLA. I felt that he was going to run as an MLA. And whatever it was, I thought that he shifted his residence officially to Calcutta. So he was going to vote there. He was previously registered as a voter in Maharashtra. I thought that was the beginning, that he was going to be given that seat. And somehow, somewhere, those negotiations have fallen through. And I guess we will never know what exactly it was. I'm pretty sure it has nothing to do with his background or, his beliefs, because of course he wouldn't be here if that was a question. I'm pretty much sure that it was simply why, offers for the CEO fall through. I mean, I just think that that's the reason why it fell through. But of course, it creates a very interesting situation at this point of time as to who will be, in case the BJP is able to form a government, but I still don't think that, I'm pretty sure that the CPM and the Congress will not support the BJP. So, but of course, there is of course a chance that BJP will be the, and I think BJP could be the single largest party also, by the way. It's just that I think that the Trinamool Congress will be able to cobble up a majority. It might be an unstable majority, but they still might be able to cobble up a majority. And and coalition politics has been the norm actually in Bengal for many decades, and people almost forget that the CPM, even though they were the dominant coalition partners, And the other coalition partners kind of felt like they were children of a lesser god, but it was actually a coalition that ruled Bengal. It was a left front. So it was not just Jyoti Basu's CPM. There was the Revolutionary Socialist Party. There was the CPI. There was Forward Bloc. So there were, you know, again, these party names possibly come out in trivia competitions only. They have no other significance. But still, they were, and at this point of time, Congress is, it's pretty much a trivia question also. So, but I still feel that the Trinamool Congress will be better positioned to leverage a quote-unquote, and I use the word quote-unquote with full import, secular coalition against the BJP. However, there is, of course, still a chance in any politics, and you can definitely see that Mamata Banerjee's rattled, the BJP might be able to form a government on their own. So if they're able to form a government on their own, it's worthwhile speculating who might be their chief ministerial candidate. And I was thinking of, on those lines, and I don't think there's any easy answer to that. So the first candidate that comes up, given that there's no Mithun and there is no Sourav Ganguly, is of course going to be Dilip Ghosh. So for those of you who don't follow Bengal politics very closely, Dilip Ghosh kind of emerged as the more radical face, more radical on the ground face of BJP. So he is an RSS Pracharak who spent a lot of time doing relief work in the Andaman Nicobar Islands during the tsunami. And he is, again, a single, the classic RSS Pracharak, very, very forward. He's made incendiary speeches, doesn't hold back. He doesn't maintain, let's say, the veneer of soft secularism that BJP sometimes does when they wander into states like West Bengal, for instance, where they know that, the kind of rhetoric that might work in Uttar Pradesh doesn't really work in Bengal. But no, he's basically a Bengali version of Yogi Adityanath. And he's insanely popular among the rank and file because he is like when BJP workers get killed, unlike, the Babul Supriyos and all these guys who are essentially, of course, they're in Bombay. And so there are certain lines they will not cross. There are certain people they won't hug. There are certain places they won't go. So there's that, rung of BJP leaders. He's not like that. He's a very, very down-to-earth guy. He will get dirty. He will roll up his sleeves. He will, whatever language he believes needs to be used, he will use it. And he is very popular. And many people credit him for the on-the-ground BJP revival. So the fact that, in order for any political party to make inroads in a state like Bengal, it has to be a multi-level operation. So there needs to be somebody who gets people like agitated on the ground. This is the more mobilization of thousands of people. Then there are the people like Mukul Roy, who basically turn politicians. They're the guys who are in charge of money and influence and fear and intimidation. So they turn the Bahubalis and the middle level. So these guys are not necessarily going to bring you a lot of people. That's for the Dilip Ghoshes of the world. But these are the guys who are going to bring you influence, whether it be votes from the unions, whether it's going to be sheer money. These are the guys who do that, or whether it's just turning politicians who already have a support base. So usually what has hampered BJP has been that they haven't had a full spectrum. And again, going back to computer science, they haven't worked every layer of the OSI stack. They've only focused on a few layers and they've always been, been embarrassed because of that. But over the past few years, that's not been the case. So they have taken they have expanded their ground game, they have expanded their, let's say, administrative game, they have expanded their money game, they've expanded their fear game, they've expanded all the different aspects that are needed in order to build up something, an alternative that can actually sustain. It's not just a question of getting elected. Getting elected is, let's say stage one. You have to then stay in power. Because, of course, Mamata Banerjee is going to be a force. And if there's anything that Mamata Banerjee is better than as a chief minister, it's being Mamata Banerjee, the opposition leader. She will essentially, if, God forbid, she gets in the opposition, she will bring Calcutta to a halt.
He will build into a, you know, you can imagine, this is a person who, while being the chief minister of a state, essentially claims that the RAW, which is the part of the same Indian government, has, and I'll come to that, has essentially fabricated a terrorist conspiracy in Burdwan. This is a person who, even while being a part of the government apparatus, treats the government apparatus in this way. And people call Trump and his supporters, you know, that they're undermining the elections, they're undermining democracy. There's no problem if Mamata Banerjee does the same as an elected representative. Now imagine when she's in opposition, what she's going to do. So the BJP has been building, and so Dilip Ghosh is very much a part of this ground game. Now, Dilip Ghosh, again, the problem with Dilip Ghosh is going to be that, whether it is morally right or not, but Kolkata and this expectation of a kind of privileged culture has always been one of the ticks that a chief minister has to have in order to have authority in the state. There is this expectation, which is a very unique Bengali expectation, I would say. Now, some people would say the expectation is changing. I would say perhaps that Dilip Ghosh himself will say the expectation is changing. But there's always been the expectation that the chief minister is a person of letters, is an intellectual. And so initially, the chief ministers were actually intellectuals. You had a great doctor who was an intellectual. You had somebody, as Datta Sankare, at least, you know, he spoke. I don't know how, you know, what level of intellect he actually had. Jyoti Basu also, the same question as to what level of, but at least he was a barrister. You know, he had that veneer of polish. He had that polish. Then there was Buddhadev Bhattacharya, who was definitely an intellectual, definitely a well-read person. And then Mamata Banerjee wasn't a well-read person, but then she fabricated an history of being well-read, of being a great artist, of being a great poet. And as everybody knows, you know, that the fact that, you know, in order to pay money to TMC, you have to buy her paintings. Her poems are like the biggest bestsellers in Bengal, because I'm pretty sure that everybody buys one, for reasons that perhaps have nothing to do with the intrinsic poetic content of the pages. But this is perhaps rather unique, that a leader, in order to get the legitimacy to rule, has to either be an intellectual or needs to pivot to become an intellectual. Now, I'm guessing it's going to be a little difficult for Dilip Ghosh, especially some of his pronouncements on, you know, cows and gold in cow milk and other things. You know, whenever Dilip Ghosh gets interviewed, you'll find everybody will bring this up. And they bring this up in order to trivialize him, that question is not really for Dilip Ghosh. It's for the audience, because Dilip Ghosh, I've seen two of his interviews. I've seen the one that News Laundry did with him, and I've seen the one that Shumon from ABP did with him. And my personal understanding of Dilip Ghosh was like he was basically a rabble rouser. But when I saw his interview, I was really impressed. I mean, this guy is smart. I mean, he has interview presence, and he comes off. I mean, I was very impressed. Again, I could understand where he is going to. People are going to look at him and say, is that my chief minister? Because again, there's another thing within Bengal, whether people will come out and say it or not is another thing. But the Bengali you speak, even if you speak Bengali, there is a kind of accent that people expect, which is actually comes from the district of Bardhaman, which is the canonical Bengali accent. Now, with Bengali accent, there are multiple Bengali accents. There's a Bengali accent in Purulia, there's a Bengali accent from Bangladesh, but then there is this Bengali accent which is considered to be pure, authentic, and you know, the kind that Bhadralok speak, and that's not his accent. So he's going to have trouble with, and all his interviewers who are obviously, you can see the hate his guts, they always try to bring that out, you know. So you can see that. But he's smart enough to also realize that they're trying to do that. And I've seen his interviews, and I was very impressed. I mean, this should not be taken as an endorsement of some of his hateful rhetoric. But you know, given my own personal beliefs, I don't believe in the kind of rhetoric that he utters. But I do admire the fact that he is good in front of the camera. And so that he won't perhaps be a terrible chief minister, in the sense that if you think that Yogi Adityanath, as of course, when he came to be chief minister, I was a little shocked. You know, maybe that could be replicated in Bengal. Who knows? And I think he's counting on it. I think one of the questions that's often asked of him is, are you trying to be the chief minister? And he doesn't say, no, I don't care. He says, no, our party doesn't announce chief ministerial candidates before the elections. And he repeatedly brings up the example of Yogi Adityanath. And it's not accidental that he does. I think what he's trying to say is, I am like Yogi Adityanath. So and I think this question was asked, well, what are you going to do if you're not the chief minister? And he didn't say explicitly, you know what, if I'm not the chief minister, I'm going to be perfectly fine with it. And I really don't care about any of this. I will work as a foot soldier. No, he didn't say that. So I think he is definitely, if he brings in the election, he will have a huge say as the boots on the ground guy. But that's not, as I said, that's not the only part of defeating Mamata Banerjee. There is the person who does the middle part of it. Now, that guy would be Mukul Roy. But Mukul Roy is not going to be the chief minister. I don't think so. With his past and with his association with multiple scams. And also, I think that he's not particularly, and even his tenure as a railway minister, he was pretty terrible. So I think that, some people aren't cut out to be, I would say, a public-facing politician. They might be very good backroom people. And Mukul Roy is an absolutely sensational backroom person in terms of he's the guy who gets people to flip. He's the guy who has sit-downs. He's the guy who negotiates deals. But he's not a guy who can inspire a crowd. He's not a guy who can get the crowd all riled up, or he can really stand up in front of, let's say, investors and talk about Bengal leads. He doesn't have that. And I don't think he's interested in it either, honestly. So I wouldn't consider him to be a chief ministerial candidate, which brings me another guy who I believe is, even though he doesn't say so, it's Shubhendu Adhikari. Because Shubhendu Adhikari actually belongs to a political family which has been kind of a strong man, kind of a Bahubali kind of family in the area. Again, it's outside Calcutta. So, these people normally haven't so far come into the public reckoning of, because, Bengal, it's very Calcutta-centric, whether it be the media, whether it be the literary circle, because Bengal is one of the states which doesn't have a major second city. It doesn't have a Pune to a Mumbai. It's just a one state with, one big city, which kind of dominates its culture and politics, which kind of, I would say, stifles the growth of the rest of Bengal. And so many people in Bengal haven't heard of the power of the Adhikari family. But the Adhikari family is a huge deal. And the fact that Mamata Banerjee was able to kickstart her campaign against CPM was once the Adhikaris basically threw their lot with her during Nandigram. These were the guys who beat Lakhan Sheth of CPM. So this family is a very, very important, powerful, like they have boots on the ground, they have money, they own everything in that place. And so Shubhendu Adhikari is the scion of that family. Now again, Shubhendu Adhikari doesn't have that clipped Bengali accent that people like, but he is fighting one-on-one with Mamata Banerjee. But if he is able to defeat Mamata Banerjee in a one-on-one battle, then he, I believe, shoots to the front of who is the next chief minister. Because if he can take on Mamata Banerjee one-on-one and best her in Nandigram, which he can, given the fact that the very fact that Mamata Banerjee is reaching out to one of the low-level flunkies of Shubhendu Adhikari in order to get him to flip, because I guess this is Prashant Kishore's strategy coming up, that if she gets some people to flip, then she can make an inroad at the last minute. But there's definitely desperation going on. So whether the Trinamool Congress overall gets power, I think, and I said this before in this podcast, that I think that Mamata Banerjee made a big mistake. This was, again, it was not, I believe, a political decision. It was an emotional decision. It's the kind of person she is, that she decided that she will go and fight the Adhikaris on their home ground, because she felt it was a personal insult that they basically flipped over to the BJP, and she wants to kind of assert her dominance in the state, that, hey, you adhikaris may be the big deal, may think that this place is yours and you own this place, but I can beat you to pulp in your own home. I think that hubris basically drove her to contest because there were multiple seats. I mean, she is the most important candidate of Trinamool Congress. She's competing on only one seat. She should have taken a safer seat. There are many safe seats that she can take where Trinamool Congress is going to win in a canter. But she decided to take a very challenging seat in a place where the Trinamool Congress hasn't delivered on its promises, where she's up against one of their local toughs there. And this guy is not just a mobilizer of people. These guys have money in that place. They have money, they have influence, and she's up against. So I think that, again, if Shubhendu Adhikari can beat Mamata Banerjee in a one-on-one competition, I think that definitely elevates his own personal brand. And that might work to the detriment of Dilip Ghosh at that point of time. Which brings me to the last candidate, who hasn't been spoken of. And I've kind of been a little intrigued by Shapunda Gupta. So Shapunda Gupta, I believe, is contesting elections this time. He resigned from his seat he's contesting. Why is he contesting? For me, I've been intrigued, but I'm not getting where that is going. Because he's kind of been a marginal player in Bengal. And he's just not that kind of a guy. He's not Dilip Ghosh. He just can't be. But the only thing that he brings to the party is exactly the thing that Dilip Ghosh and Shubhendu Adhikari don't have. He brings that intellectual gravitas. He brings that very nice English accent in which he speaks. He genuinely has, the intellectual chops. And so he would kind of fit in perfectly with the model of the chief minister that Bengal is used to having. And that's why I'm so intrigued by this, is that what will the Amit Shahs want? Will they think that, look, BJP as a party is not a party that Bengal is used to? So maybe it might be a little bit too much of change. If not only if they have a new party, but they have a different kind of chief minister than the ones they're used to. So maybe they might think that if the shock of the Saffron as the ruling party in Calcutta isn't radical enough, maybe they might want to go a little easy on the chief minister and maybe have somebody who doesn't have the kind of history of rhetoric that Dilip Ghosh has, because Dilip Ghosh is not going to change. He is a loose cannon. He is going to keep on making those incendiary comments even when he's the chief minister. And that's really the appeal of Dilip Ghosh. He's what you see. There is no filter. He's not a quote-unquote politician. He speaks his mind. I think in one of the interviews, somebody said, there are many people who essentially attacked you, in one of the interviews, who attacked you physically, and these people are now in your own party. And how do you react to it? He just gave like a smirk and said, well, then who won the fight then? So it was a brilliant answer. but the fact is that he's a fighter. And, is the state ready for that kind of a chief minister? I'm not sure they are. Of course, there is the problem as to what happens if you don't make him the chief minister. What does he do at that point of time? Because as you can see in Bengal, people change, people flip. So will he go over to Trinamool at that point of time? I mean, I struggle to think of it in those terms. But, stranger things have happened with Shubhendu Adhikari. How would he react? Well, if he loses his seat to Mamata Banerjee, I think he wouldn't have the momentum to then, again, this is again, the presumption is that BJP is able to form a government. I don't think he will be in a position that he can claim to be the person to form the government. Which, of course, leaves somebody like Shapunda Gupta to be someone who is a compromise candidate. He is a compromise candidate in many ways. First of all, he meets that criteria of intellectualism to the T. Second, some people could say, why not Ambuj Mohanty? For those of you who don't know, Ambuj Mohanty is a long-time BJP activist. And he is an ex, he's a retired Indian Institute of Management Calcutta professor. I personally know him. I've visited his house many times. He was my mentor when I was doing my undergraduate in Jadavpur University, Computer Science and Engineering. He's a great help. And so, you know, I personally have a lot of love for him as somebody, a lot of love and respect and gratitude for, you know, his contribution. So, you know, when I'm talking about him, I should make that clear. But again, I haven't interacted with him as a BJP politician. He and I have never had a conversation on politics or on BJP. It was always on AI and data structures and, should you focus on doing computer networking? Is it going to last? What is wireless? What is wireless division multiplexing? Is that? So, you know, all my conversations with him had nothing to do with politics. It was, again, politics was not something that you discussed with elders. I never did. But the fact was, I, of course, knew. And then, of course, once he retired, he became more and more involved in BJP politics. And again, he is somebody who is, of course, an intellectual. He's, he has the intellectual chops, but still, he's not a known name in Delhi. He doesn't have that, you know. And I don't think even Shapun Das Gupta has. I mean, Shapun Das Gupta is very well known in Delhi. He's well known in the channels. In terms of the kind of image that the BJP would want to project, he might fit the bill slightly better than Dr. Mohanty. I would think that the BJP might try to put in a compromise candidate, because otherwise there is this risk of putting, the Dilip Ghosh as a chief minister. So I was planning, so this actually went on for much more than I thought it would. And I'm trying to keep these podcasts to about 40, 45 minutes. I might not succeed, but I'm trying to. So I'm not going to be getting into the other topic that I wanted to discuss, but I might do this the next week, which is a group of, again, next week will also be Bengal politics unless something path breaking or something that I really have to speak about comes in between now and next Friday, next Saturday. I have nothing to say about the Suez Canal ship, but something on those lines. I'm going to talk about this. A bunch of Bengali intellectuals came out with this cringe video. I just wanted to spend some time talking about the history of Hindutva politics and Bengal, which is, I think, something which many outside Bengal don't know, and that's okay. But, you know, many inside Bengal also don't know, because we were taught a very, very biased version of history by leftist historians who wrote our textbooks. And most of our knowledge of history is from what we read till class 10. So I just want to spend a little bit, I want to perhaps spend an episode looking at some of the historical aspects of the quote-unquote Hindu identity in Bengal, which I believe hasn't, and which often even I was not aware of when I was growing up. And the basic thing is that one of the things, and there's a bunch of Bengal intellectuals led by Paramroto who came out with this social media statement and a kind of a cringe video. As an aside, what's wrong with Bengali directors, man? Can't they even make a 5-minute propaganda video? Seriously, what's wrong with these guys? So in that, they, of course, called BJP fascist, Nazi, and Manuvad. And they're not pulling any punches, of course. And what they're trying to say is that this Hindu Manuvadi ethos is against Bengali culture. And it is foreign, it is bohiragato, it is an outsider thing. The implication, of course, is that the Hindu identity is kind of, is contrary to Bengali identity. And it came from outside. Historically, this is not true. And we have been taught to think of these lines because of the history that we were fed, that essentially that everything was peaceful communally in Bengal forever. And had it not been for the dastardly British who divided this country for their own narrow sectarian interests, everybody would have, you know, been singing Kumbaya. Which was a nice thing to believe, but it's not true. So there's been
you know, Bengal has been historically been fractured on communal lines. Very, and this should be evident. I mean, it's, you know, a British power can't make you do the kind of communal violence and bloodbath of partition. I mean, people know in India, they know of the partition of the western part of the country. That's been covered in television series, and that's been covered like hazard times, because of course most of our cultural focus is on the north. But very less attention has been paid to the much more severe consequences of partition on the east, because in the west what happened was that there was a more or less equitable transfer of masses. So there was land on both sides that the migrating population could move to. In Bengal, that didn't happen. There was virtually very little migration from India to East Pakistan. And there was a massive migration the other way. So there was an absolute asymmetry in the population exchange. So not only was there carnage during partition, carnage continued after partition. So Bengal has had a long, long history of what Parambrata would call fascist, Nazi, and Monuvadi politics, except that these people either willfully don't want to acknowledge it, or they're just ignorant of it. And they think, because this is tied to the general Bengal parochial reaction to the BJP, that they're all outsiders, they're Gujaratis, Marwaris. It's all like, we are Bengalis, we are superior to everybody else, and these BJPs, they're not really Bengalis at all. You know, they're all, ultimately, none of them are really Bengalis. This is of course, what Trinamool Congress's biggest card is right now. And these quote-unquote Bengali intellectuals are basically supporting that in kind of a little circular way. But I wanted to spend some time discussing about the more communal implications of, I mean, what's the history of Bengal? I mean, what is the fact that Dilip Ghosh can get within 5 years an army of foot soldiers, is that an aberration? Does that never exist? I wanted to spend some time on it, but I mean, I'm going to follow it because that's going to take quite a bit of time, I believe. So I think I'll terminate this show. Lend this show rather. Terminate has a strange sound of it, but I will, you know, think this is a good time. I haven't been checking as to how long this episode is. I think it is going to be around 40 minutes, 50 minutes maybe, and I want to keep it there and there and whereabouts moving forward, especially if we don't have guests, because, you know, if I'm talking and I'm the only person, it just gets, I mean, physically, it just becomes very difficult for me to, you know, continually speak for more than 45, 50 minutes. So I'll stop here for today. Maybe I'll resume this conversation next episode, or maybe not next episode, maybe in a few episodes, but that's a topic to talk for another day, which is the communal history of Bengal and the quote-unquote Hindutva identity, which again was something we discussed with Rahul last week. In closing, the last thing that I wanted to say was that, of course, I had Rahul Roshan on my show last week, and of course got a lot of positive feedback and a lot of negative feedback, which I expected. You know, how can you be a centrist and have Rahul Roshan on your show? Again, those same people had no problem when I had Avinandan Sekri on the show, and there were some people who had problems with when I had Avinandan Sekri on the show, and they said, how can you give that guy a platform? And they had no problem when I had Rahul Roshan on the show. But so, I mean, the thing is that I just want to make clear that the purpose of this show is to provide a platform for people of any opinion. I don't necessarily have to agree with what they say, but it's important for me as a liberal. And again, this show is ultimately my show. So who gets on it is, you just can't kind of, well, you call this guy from this extreme, why didn't you call that guy who's on the same extreme or who's on the same side of the political spectrum? No, the who I decide to call ultimately depends on who I think is interesting and who I think I can have a productive conversation with. So ultimately, it's my show, my call. I'm sorry. But the thing is, I do want Attention Please to provide a platform to people of different political opinions. And for me, that's the important thing about centrism. the notion of centrism isn't that you don't have prejudices or you don't have biases or you don't. I mean, everybody does. Every human being does. Anybody who claims to have, who expects to be totally objective on everything, is the only thing you're sure about him is that person is a liar. So the objective of centrism is that once you have your own biases and prejudices and your own worldview, you are consistent with that. That's the only thing that's expected, that you don't fluctuate from based on the issue from one extreme to another just because it's convenient for you. That's really where it all breaks down. So for me, it's important that I provide, within the limits of my comfort zone and within my limits of who I can interact with, a set of people whose ideas I might not totally believe in. I might believe in some of them, but I want to provide everybody an opportunity to come here and talk about what they feel. Again, the only thing is they have to be interesting. They have to be somebody that I personally can have a conversation with, because ultimately it's my show. And with respect to the person, I mean, that's the thing. I do not believe in cancel culture. I also do not believe in deplatforming. And again, this is not, it's not a worthwhile platform, my show. I mean, my show's reach is very limited. It's kind of a little presumptuous of me to even call it a platform that anybody would even like to be part of. But whatever it is, whatever its reach be, my main thing is I want to moving forward. And the only thing is often sometimes I'm limited by, and be very honest, I mean, in terms of the kind of guests that I can get. I mean, ultimately, most of my guests that I reach out to are people who are people I have known, who are like my, you know, I wouldn't call them friends, but people I know, like Abhinandan. I went to News Laundry, I met him, so I could call him. I could send him an email and say, "Hi, Abhinandan, would you like to come to this show?" With Rahul, I have talked to him off and on for many years now. So again, he's somebody that I personally know. So ultimately, it is often, and the thing is, people come onto the show when they know me. That's also true. So I would obviously like to, moving forward, have to have many guests. One of the things I want to do is have more guests. But the only two things is, I don't care what the guest thinks. I'm perfectly fine with people from any side of the political spectrum. But there should be a minimum level of good faith in my understanding of what they're coming from and their understanding of where I come from. So there needs to be some amount of, let's say, quote unquote, connection. And secondly, the guy needs to be somebody who I can talk with. There are many people who, when I see them interact on social media, I realize I can't talk with these guys. I just can't. They are either because of my age or because they're just in a very different world than I am. I just cannot continue. And this may be perhaps a failing of me, that I just cannot converse with them in a way that I think provides value to my listeners. Maybe if and once I get become a better, better host and become more comfortable with the media, maybe I'll be able to handle this much better. And maybe, as I said, this possibly is one of my shortcomings. But for now, I want to restrict my guests to people whom I believe that I can do a good show with. I don't really care what they believe in, and I don't need to agree. As a matter of fact, I hope that I bring people whom I don't agree with. Otherwise, if I get somebody who agree with totally, then that's not a particularly good show, right? I mean, why would I have an exact echo of me? You can just listen to this podcast again. So that's, I got a lot of criticism and some emails regarding this. I just wanted to address this over here, that for my listeners, again, if this is something which bothers you, I would regret having to lose listeners. But, if your thing is, I'm never going to listen to you because you had so-and-so guy on this show, then, all right, I'm sorry to lose you, but that's just the way it's going to be. It is going to have people from different political opinions. And that's really the whole thing about centrism. It's the whole thing about opposing the centrifuge, the move to the extremity centrifugal effect of social media conversations. It is to make sure that maybe our conversations are radicalized. There's nothing that I can do about it. And maybe we are all moving to the extremes.
But that doesn't mean that we cannot look at the entire spectrum. We haven't reached that stage yet where we can't even take a step back and look at the spectrum. So summing up, that's really what I'm going to endeavor to do, maybe imperfectly, and maybe much of that is because I'm not good enough, but that's really what it's going to be. So that's really going to be my last statement on this. Finally, for those of you who listen to the show, who continue supporting this show on Patreon, thanks a lot for your monthly contributions. For those of you who aren't a Patreon, I would strongly encourage you to consider being a Patreon. Patreon starts at $1 a month, which I believe is fairly reasonable. You can become a Patreon for $1, and there's goes up to $25 a month. And this really helps the show. It keeps, as I like to say, the reason why I like this is when people are willing to pay for something on their own, that is the biggest sign of endorsement. And ultimately, the reason why I do this show is for your endorsement. And so this is, while I do love the listens, I do love the engagements, and I want to encourage everybody to listen and to engage with me on social media, a monthly contribution would be just another, one more elevated way of showing that you appreciate the effort that goes into bringing this show to you. That's really the only reason. As I've always said, there is no content which is firewalled. Everything is available for everyone. So that will always remain. So thanks a lot for listening. And hopefully we will be back next week with another episode of Attention Please. Till then, keep listening. Bye-bye.